Welcome to the first proper episode on the Tortured Poets Department. My name is Tess. I go by she, they pronouns. And I am currently wearing my version of a Tortured Poets Department outfit. So for those who are only listening to audio, I am wearing my white over-the-ear headphones, which perfectly seem to match with Tortured Poets Department aesthetic. I'm wearing a black velvet choker with a little white love heart pearl on it. I am wearing a white lacy type blouse with a black pinafore dress over the top. So I have felt the neurodivergent urge to dress for the occasion and, yeah, wear an outfit that I think suits. This episode is going to be an analysis of the lead up to the release of the Tortured Poets Department. And the Tortured Poets Department is going to be released a few days from the time that I'm recording this. So you might listen to this before it drops. Probably you'll listen to this afterwards. But we'll be analysing the lead up to the release date regardless. I'm wanting to speak about where I've been. This is the second episode of Friends of Dorothea podcast that has made it out past the nest of Patreon, out into the world, onto Spotify and other platforms. And there's been a huge gap since the first episode of Friends of Dorothea back in October of last year, 2023. It feels weird that this is the first time that I have the opportunity to say thank you to all of the people who listened to that first episode. It went very well, incredibly well, way better than any of us could have expected. In Spotify Music podcast charts, when we released this episode, it peaked at number 31 in the UK. It peaked at number 9 in Australia. Of all of the podcasts in the music category in these countries, and it peaked at number 8 in America, which was surreal, shocking, exciting, nerve-wracking, all of those things at once. I really didn't quite know how to cope with it. We were above podcasts like Song Exploder, which I've listened to, which is a super professional podcast about analyzing music. We were above Norah Jones's podcast. And fun fact about me, when I did singing lessons as a teenager, the first song that I ever performed at a concert in front of everyone as a solo was Norah Jones's Don't Know Why. So shout out to Norah Jones. I really never expected to be on a chart anywhere above her. I really didn't expect that podcast to blow up, the first episode to blow up in that way. I thought that this was going to be a weird little podcast on a corner of the internet, and there would be maybe 20 or 30 weirdos like me, maximum 100, that would be listening to this and taking the time to listen to me speak about queer analysis of Taylor Swift. So it turns out that this kind of subject, there's either way more weirdos than I thought, or maybe what we're doing here is not quite as weird as I imagined it to be. Either way, thank you so much again for listening to that episode. It was a really emotional week for me, for Jem, who helped me produce that episode. And at the same time as that was happening, I was going to my first protests for Palestine. And this is me starting to explain what happened in terms of the gap between that first episode and now. It took up a lot of headspace to learn what I needed to learn and what I was long overdue learning about the history of Palestine and Israel's occupation of Palestine. I was going to marches on the weekends. I was learning history that I'd never learnt before. And at the same time, trying to grapple with the wild success of the first episode and how I wanted to move forward with continuing with this podcast. This was around the same time that Taylor Swift was starting to really hit a new peak in her career. She was dating Travis Kelce. She was, on the front cover of Time magazine. She was about to become a billionaire. The Eras Tour was wildly successful. I started to feel like I couldn't quite relate to her anymore. There was a part of me that, for most of the time I've been a fan of her music, felt like she was relatable, or it felt like she felt more human to me. And around that time when I was really grappling with some of the worst things that were happening in this world, it felt difficult to me to simultaneously grapple with Taylor on the verge of becoming a billionaire and really leaning into the American stereotype of most popular girl in school / the country dates most popular jock boy in the school / country. At first, I was upset with myself for not continuing with this podcast at the rate that I had wanted to. But in retrospect, I'm really proud of myself and glad that I have taken this time to really deeply process, take these feelings to therapy. I'm also currently training to be a therapist, so there was those things going on in my life as well. But I feel like it was really important for me to take that break to process the success of the podcast and how I wanted to change up my plan moving forward, given the success of that first episode, processing, witnessing the horror of what was happening in Gaza and stepping into activism in a way that I had not for many years, and processing how it felt to be a consumer of Taylor Swift's art, given all of these things that were happening in my life and in the world. And so this is my first attempt of bringing all of these things together. I don't want to leave my personal values at the door when I record these podcast episodes. I don't want to leave the cultural context that Taylor Swift is dropping her music into. I don't want to leave the part of me that feels like my understanding of queer history and therefore my understanding of my own queer identity. There's a part of me that feels like that is inextricably linked at this point with Taylor Swift's art. It feels like she has guided me through some really important history. I am trying to hold all of those parts at the same time. It's something that I'm doing in my therapy journey in general, trying to find room enough in myself and in my psyche, in my mind, for all of the different parts of me to coexist, even if some parts want to kick other parts out. There's a cynical part of me that thinks, How can I possibly create a podcast about a billionaire when I believe that billionaires shouldn't exist? That cynical part really wants to squash the part of me that enjoys the queer analysis and queer history and queer community that creating this podcast brings to me. Without further ado, let's get into my analysis of the lead up to the Tortured Poets Department. In this episode, we are going to be covering the overarching themes that I am picking up on in the lead up to the Tortured Poets Department. And spoiler alert, they don't feel all that different to this inner turmoil that I've just described from my own life. I'm going to be analyzing the title, The Tortured Poets Department. I'm going to be analyzing the cover art for this album. We'll also explore the different meanings that could be behind the release date, April 19th. I will provide a brief being the emphasized word, a brief analysis of her announcement post / poem. I have cut out the full analysis of that and will be putting that on my Patreon as a 40-minute bonus episode alongside my analysis of her use of ghost and phantom imagery when describing her vinyl variants. So if you're really keen on a really deep dive, and by deep dive I mean I leave no stone unturned in terms of this announcement post, and it was a really enjoyable analysis to create. I just don't want this podcast episode to be too long. So if you're keen on those, I'll put the links on how to get those bonus episodes into the bio of this episode. And finally, I'll be wrapping up at the end with my conclusion on how Tortured Poets Department promo has felt in the lead up to the album release. The first thing that I want to speak about is the title, The Tortured Poets Department. On my Patreon, I have a 30-minute video that's all about the the website glitch that happened on her website before she announced the Tortured Poets Department. So if you're interested in that, you can find that on Patreon. But I'm now going to speak about the title, the Tortured Poets Department. Now, the first thing that really stood out to me about this title is that we have a contrast or a juxtaposition in the title itself. And this really captures the kind of themes that I want to bring together in this exploration video. We have the concept of tortured poet, dramatic, emotional poets that are kind of masochistic in their sort of languishing in their pain. It really plays into the stereotype of poets and artists being people who need to experience pain in order to create art. It's sort of melodramatic in quite a purposeful way. And then we've got the word department, which has connotations of, you know, structured academia or corporate business, a group of people that are all organized either in a university or in a business or in an office building. So already for me, just by the title of this album, we have a sense that there are this push and pull, these opposites that are being forced to be together. If I was the chairman of a department full of tortured poets, I would find that quite stressful. Departments are all about like getting things done, either teaching students or creating products or meeting targets. And tortured poets are people that I don't really think are wanting to do those kind of things. So for me, in the title itself, we already have this sort of tug of war in terms of concepts. And I think that this contrast is obviously very deliberate in her choosing. The other thing that I want to note is the context, the social context in which the Tortured Poets Department was announced. So for me personally, I was really struggling at the time with coming to terms with being a commentator on Taylor Swift or being a fan of her work, given that there were some things that the celebrity Taylor, and I say celebrity Taylor because I'm kind of trying to delineate or show the differences between the different sort of roles of Taylor that we receive. But celebrity Taylor was dating like one of the biggest football players in America, really playing into that sort of popular girl of the high school dates popular jock boy image. We had Taylor not saying much or doing much about the genocide in Gaza at the moment. And that was something that I was learning about a lot and really like being quite active in. And that felt there was a contrast in me about loving her music and being a fan of her music, and then also finding it difficult to, I guess, relate to her anymore. I think this is one of the areas where I felt the least like I relate to Taylor Swift. And so we've got the idea of Taylor releasing the Tortured Poets Department at the same time as she's hit billionaire status, another thing that has happened recently that I don't agree with, because you can't have an ethical billionaire. And we've got this idea of like a tortured poet also being a billionaire is a really, it's not an image that is harmonious. There is a discordant feeling in that. And so I just wanted to bring those things into this title too, because when she first announced this title, I was struggling with the ideas of, you know, the imagery that is coming out of the horror of what's being done to the people of Gaza and by Israel. And then you've got Taylor Swift announcing an album that uses sort of war imagery, which we'll get into when we look at the announcement, as well as the word tortured. Didn't quite sit right with me. This feels like one of the first times where it doesn't feel like Taylor completely has her finger on the pulse. Because Folklore and Evermore were such like cottagecore vibes and everyone was really into cottagecore then. And, you know, Red was released when everyone was really into preppy kind of styles. So, yeah, this is one of the first album promotion cycles that have felt a bit out of touch with the ordinary people of the world. And also really out of touch with her image that she's presenting to the world. This sort of
popular cheerleader girl who's wearing her boyfriend's jerseys and going to support all of his football games and cheering quite like emphatically is a really different image to a tortured poet working away in academia in a department. Okay, so that gives you a bit of an idea of how I at least personally feel about this title being dropped at the same time as everything that's going on in her celebrity world, as well as the world in general. A lot of Swifties have pointed out that Dead Poets Society is really similar to Tortured Poets Department, and Dead Poets Society is a movie that was released in, you guessed it, 1989, the year that Taylor Swift was born. So I rewatched Dead Poets Society a few weeks ago just to kind of remind myself of the movie and the plotline and how it feels. And, you know, you can go and look up the synopsis of the Dead Poets Society, but what I find interesting about these sort of connections is the Dead Poets Society is a secret society that the boys at this very prestigious boarding school in America, where like academic success and achievement is supposed to be like the pinnacle of being a person that brings value to this world. Boys that are in that academic environment find a teacher that is really inspiring and inspires them through poetry, and through the power and magic and like authentic humanness of poetry, they create a small group that meets in the middle of the night in this sort of cave on campus and read each other poems from dead poets, which is also obviously very reminiscent of one of Taylor's only lines about poetry, which is "From the lakes, take me to the lakes where all the poets went to die." I'll speak about this more later, but Dead Poets Society being a potential reference here is interesting to me in terms of this idea of what you should do, what like society and the school and the principal and the parents all wanted these boys to be, and what the boys actually wanted to be or actually wanted to do with their time or actually wanted to express creatively. And spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched it, and also trigger warning in terms of discussion of suicide. One of the boys who has the most pressure to become successful in the way that society and this school deems realizes that he wants to be an actor. And because of his father's disapproval of that and the despair that that causes him, he ends up taking his own life at a really emotional part in the film. So, yeah. In terms of Taylor Swift and the Dead Poets Society, this really speaks to me of the theme that I think continues to crop up in this promotion of the album, of the contrast, juxtaposition between the emotional, creative part of someone and society's expectations of them. The part of someone that wants to rebel against society's expectations and the part that has to follow along with society's expectations. The other thing that a lot of Swifties have noted is that Joe Alwyn, in an interview in 2022, in an interview with him and Paul Mescal, said that they have a group chat with Andrew Scott, and it's called the Tortured Man Club. Now, Gaylers loved this at the time because, obviously, you know, given the fact that Joe Alwyn could potentially be a beard for Taylor Swift, it's not surprising that we are, as a part of the fandom, quite aware of who Joe Alwyn could be close with in terms of men, especially gay men. And Andrew Scott is, you know, obviously epitome of gay male celebrity, especially a gay male celebrity that millennials love. And Paul Mescal has been the person that Gaylers have joked about Joe Alwyn being in a romantic relationship with. Maybe it goes further than joking, I don't know, but at least in my mind, it's been the running joke. So when this interview first came out, the Gaylers were up in arms about the sort of, not up in arms, very excited about the Tortured Man's Club as an idea, especially the connotations of tortured men being gay. And so from a Gayler perspective, because you can find the Swifty perspective of this anywhere, it's really interesting to me that this could potentially be a reference that people think means that it's connected to a straight narrative of Taylor Swift making a reference to Joe Alwyn's group chat. But to me, this just screams gay and gay. And finally, department and poets both of those words allude to a group of people, not just a singular person. It's not the tortured poet department or the tortured poet chairman. So department really gives an idea of a group and a group that work together. It's interesting to me that I think Taylor Swift has been making commentary on all the different parts of herself that are in conflict sometimes. I'm really thinking of the visuals from the Anti-Hearing music video where we have the kind of celebrity Taylor versus the real, more authentic Taylor. We have similar visuals in the Ready For It music video, and I'm going to be mentioning Ready For It plenty of times in this analysis, so please get ready for that. I hope you're ready for it. So yeah, this dichotomy, this sort of contrast of like the inner conflict of Taylor interests me going into the Torture Poets Department, because is a department of people with like Taylor Swift, Jack Antonoff, Aaron Dessner, you know, Florence and the Machine is on this, Post Malone is on this. Or could it also be speaking to the department of tortured poets or the department of people that create Taylor Swift's tortured poet imagery, art disseminated around the world, etc.? So that's what I have to say about the title. A few thoughts on the album cover. I mean, this is the first time that Taylor Swift's body has been the central focus of an album cover. Usually it's her face or the back of her head. We have never gotten an album cover that's quite like this. Although we do have only half of her face showing, which is reminiscent of 1989, which is reminiscent of sort of the shadow that's across her face and the Reputation album cover. She's been doing this a lot. A lot of people speak about the way that she covers her face in different ways or doesn't show her full face, and Torture Poets Department album cover is no exception. I'm interested in the idea of like this very sensual, sexy, vulnerable, feminine, soft photograph, maybe symbolizing the commodification of her body, because if it's the first time that her body has been used as promotion for an album, it's interesting how much that links to the idea of her body of work. And I saw someone on Twitter today point out that Taylor said in an interview once that sometimes when she puts out an album about her personal life, it can feel like a public live-streamed autopsy. And so it's interesting that we've got a real focus on her body in this album cover. I also want to say, because this is a podcast made for the sapphics, the queers of the world, that this album cover feels so much the women's gaze here. It's soft and sensual. You've got the sort of strap of her little sheer top, like on the side of her shoulder. It's like, it doesn't feel, at least to me, doesn't feel like it particularly plays into the male gaze. Although, you know, there obviously is part of that here. We can't escape it. But yeah, I just wanted to shout out to all of the sapphic people who saw this cover and immediately felt seen in some way. I also feel like it insinuates to me that she's going to be revealing more in this album, because she's revealing more skin, more of her body on this album cover. And I just want to point out that the fact that a department is being linked with this photograph is interesting, because a department obviously gives us a sense of professionalism, of doing things by the book, and posing in a bed in sort of sheer kind of underwear and lingerie is not the most professional business photograph department imagery that we could be seeing. So the release date is the 19th of April. Currently it's Wednesday the 17th of April, so it's not that long away at all. And the things that I want to say about this is that, yeah, the Swifties have pointed out that on this date last year, Taylor Swift was seen with a number of friends, including like Gigi Hadid, like Blake Lively, the Haim sisters, and people were noticing that all of those friends were unfollowing Joe Alwyn on socials. So that's one of the sort of links to Joe Alwyn that people are making with this date. But the other link that I've been seeing Swifties make to April 19th, I am far more interested in.
I was watching a YouTube video from a Swiftie called Ali Sheehan, and she was speaking about different theories related to the Torture Poets Department. And she mentioned that April 19th is the day that is seen as the start of the American Revolution. And it has been nicknamed as the day that there was a shot heard round the world. This line, shot heard round the world, comes from a poem called Concord Hymn, written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And in this poem, he's depicting the battle from that day as the beginning of the American Revolutionary War in 1775. This initial battle has been considered to be the first forcible resistance to British aggression, and the location considered the birthplace of American liberty. Obviously, Swifties will run with the idea that this is Taylor expressing her dislike for Joe Orwin, her ex-boyfriend who is from England, given that she's from America, through the use of the metaphor of the American Revolutionary War, a war in which America fought for its independence from England and won. Taylor may have been playing into this interpretation through the post she made on Instagram to celebrate Independence Day. I remember noticing these posts because she hadn't posted an Independence Day Instagram post in many, many years. The caption for these posts were, "Happy belated Independence Day from your local neighborhood independent girlies." And this was maybe a few months after her breakup with Joe Orwin, and had a bunch of pictures with her and her female friends. What's interesting to note is that Taylor's lyric from her 2020 album, Evermore, "You Could Hear a Hairpin Drop," has been widely speculated to be a reference to the famous news headline the day after the Stonewall Uprising. The headline read, "The Hairpin Drop Heard Around the World." In queer coding from as early as the 1950s, a person who drops hairpins is someone who is dropping hints that they are queer, usually to people who are also queer. So back in the 1950s, someone might say, "Ooh, George, you're dropping a lot of hairpins there," to mean, "Hey, George, you're making it really obvious that you're gay." This headline that was published, like, I think the morning after the Stonewall Uprising or a few mornings after the Stonewall Uprising, mixes together references to this queer code, hairpin drop, and to Emerson's famous line, "The shot heard round the world." And the mix of these two shows how significant and unmistakable this watershed moment was for the LGBTQ plus community and their rights. Therefore, Taylor releasing this album on April 19th could be hinting at another reference to this headline, especially given the fact that the other time this phrase has been widely used was in reference to the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the event that has been seen as the catalyst for World War I. Given that Taylor's second reference to dropping hairpins was made 2 years after her first reference, in her 2022 track, The Great War, when she sings, "Your Finger on My Hairpin Trigger," in a song titled Great War, which is an alternative name for World War I. Whilst her first reference to hairpin drop was suspicious, and Gaylor's said so very loudly, meant that her second reference served as a smoking gun for queer coding, at least to me and other members of my queer community. So all of that to say, I'm really intrigued by the idea that she may be referencing this headline a third time here, given that she's releasing this album on April 19th, the day when a shot was heard around the world. Will this April 19th, 2024, be another day where a shot is heard around the world between the British and the Americans? or a hairpin drop heard around the world? I guess we will see. April 19th was also the wedding date by proxy of Marie Antoinette. On the 19th of April, 1770. What's a marriage by proxy, you might be wondering? Well, the groom wasn't in the room when this first marriage happened, which was the marriage by proxy. She didn't actually meet Louis until their wedding day on the 16th of May, about a month later. So on April 19th, Marie Antoinette attended a church in Vienna to be married by proxy to her future husband. Her brother served as the groom for the ceremony, and she officially took the name and title Marie Antoinette, Dauphine of France. The reason that I'm bringing up Marie Antoinette in this array of different symbols that April 19th has is that Taylor Swift dressed up as Marie Antoinette in her Bejeweled music video and looked quite unhappy at the prospect of marrying the king, who was Jack Antonoff at the time. The other thing to note about Marie Antoinette is that, yeah, the queer code, have you heard the rumors about Marie Antoinette, was a way of lesbians finding each other in the 1800s. So you can do your own Google search on the queer history of Marie Antoinette. But what's interesting to me is that this date being the date when the marriage by proxy occurred between these two individuals, a marriage where one of them wasn't actually present, and the fact that Taylor Swift has used the term by proxy when she was discussing the different characters that she created in her Folklore and Evermore eras, and how much she was letting her own feelings come through these characters by proxy, is interesting to me. The idea of arranged marriage, marriage that two people are being forced into because their countries will love them to be married. So this, again, can play into the whole Joe Alwyn, Taylor Swift, why didn't they get married? They would have been an allyship between England and America. But it also paints the picture of the lavender marriages that have happened in the Hollywood industry for me. Shout out to Nell for reminding me of this date, because I completely forgot that Gaylers had made this connection. And shout out to the people that had tweeted about this, because that's how Nell had found out about this connection also. Again, trigger warning in terms of what I'm about to speak about next and mentions of suicide. It's interesting to note that 18th of April is the anniversary of Virginia Woolf's body being found in the river Ouse? Ouse? I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. And yeah, her body hadn't been found. She walked into a river, for anyone who doesn't know, with stones in her pockets to weigh her down, and she drowned in this river. And so given the fact that we're looking at the potential Virginia Woolf connections in the Tortured Poets Department, it's interesting to me that this anniversary and the announcement of her death by the coroner was on April 19th in London. So that might not have any relevance, but it's interesting to me. So the other significant date that a lot of Swifties have pointed out is that it is National Poetry and the Creative Mind Day on April 19th. So that is interesting given that this album is called Poets Department. And also it is National Cat Lady Day on April 19th. Who knows how much either of those dates fit in with Taylor's reasoning for releasing it on these days, but, you know, they at least raise some eyebrows in terms of Taylor's use of these national days to express herself previously. When Taylor announced Tortured Poets Department, the announcement came with a poem or a set of lyrics, we don't know yet, that came alongside this announcement. As I've already said, I have created a bonus episode of my analysis of this announcement because there was just so many different themes and threads to pull when I was analyzing it. But I wanted to just provide a quick summary here of some of the things that I noticed, as well as reading it out for you so that at least you can have it in your mind as you think about the lead up to the Tortured Poets Department. So here's the announcement post for you. And so I enter into evidence my tarnished coat of arms, my muses acquired like bruises, my talismans and charms, the tick, tick, tick of love bombs, my veins of pitch black ink, all's fair in love and poetry. Sincerely, the chairman of the Tortured Poets Department. In my full analysis of this announcement post, I speak about the violent war imagery that Taylor Swift is alluding to in this announcement post. And I speak about how that was one of the things that really jarred with me as someone who was seeing on my phone screen real life violence that was happening in Gaza, and then coming to terms with Taylor's use of words like the tick, tick, tick of love bombs in her announcement post. I also look at the history in especially the lesbian music history of speaking about proof and evidence, given the criminalization of homosexuality over the years. I speak about the muses acquired like bruises and the theme that Taylor Swift has used in terms of purple, in terms of muses being a very feminine word usually, and violets. The history of the queer history of violets is linked into that analysis that I made. I speak about how potentially the first song that Taylor Swift wrote when she was 12 years old speaks about luck and lucky charms and talismans. So it's really interesting to see that over 20 years from being a young child writing her first song to writing this announcement post, she is still very concerned with luck and charms and talismans. I speak about the slightly queer history of the phrase "all's fair in love and poetry," originally written by John Lyly back in 1578. So that's on there as well. And finally, I look at the idea of gender bending or gender expression in the fact that Taylor Swift signs off the announcement post by calling herself the chairman of the Tortured Poets Department. This bonus episode will also include my exploration of Taylor Swift's use of terms like ghosted and phantom when describing some of her variants of her vinyls. I find this particularly interesting given that she speaks about ghosts and phantoms in her first song about Joe Alwyn ever, which is Ready For It, or at least that's what we think is the first song that pertains to him. Florence and the Machine's Instagram post when the tracklist was released, she posted department head of haunted houses, so we have that haunted imagery again. Taylor obviously mashed up Exile and Haunted on the Eras Tour, and Exile is a song that she obviously claims to have written with Joe Alwyn, so there's a lot of Joe Alwyn ghost connections here. But I look at her use of the ghost phantom theme in general across her discography and look at the ways that that might express the ways that a lost love can haunt you, but also another interpretation being that when she is in these fake PR relationships, she is merely a ghost of herself. And I briefly mentioned Harry Styles' song Two Ghosts, which a lot of people think are about him and Taylor, and I find that very interesting given the idea that they might have been in a bearding relationship. So I'm interested to see how Taylor potentially explores the themes of ghosts and phantoms in her new album. I just wanted to quickly mention some of my impressions of the tracklist and the themes that I'm picking up in that tracklist, as well as the themes that I'm picking up on more generally in the lead up to the Tortured Poets Department. The first theme when looking at this tracklist might show my bias slightly, because this theme feels like it's a throwback for me to the disappointing, almost toxic parts of heterosexual culture, obviously fueled by the patriarchy. The songs "But Daddy, I Love Him," "I Can Fix Him," "My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys," and "The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived" really speak to me to some problematic ideas that can come up in patriarchal culture and heterosexual culture. And they're not too dissimilar to my experience as a heterosexual before I saw the light. I Can Fix Him, very relatable, but not in a like, I'm so proud of myself for relating to that way, in a like, I'm having to do years of therapy to stop relating to that way. But Daddy, I Love Him, and the kind of needing your father's permission in order to date a man that your father doesn't approve of. There's a lot to unpack there. The track title, My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys, really infantilizing in terms of not saying my man, but my boy, and making him out like a child who breaks his favorite things. Kind of reminds me of the sort of trope of like, oh, boys will be boys, that kind of thing. And finally, The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived. Yeah. The idea that men want to be big in order to be perceived as powerful. I really hope that some of these songs explore and tackle in a very obvious way the toxic underpinnings underneath these thought patterns. I really hope they do, but on paper, when you're just looking at the track list, yeah, they are some of the most patriarchal heterosexual culture that I think Taylor has ever played into. The other thing that I want to pick up on is this idea of forbidden love in But Daddy, I Love Him. But Daddy, I Love Him is a phrase that is said in The Little Mermaid, a film also released in 1989. So the patterns are patterning. This phrase is said by The Little Mermaid when her father finds out that she is in love with a human man, Prince Eric, and he has expressly forbidden mermaids to interact with humans in any way. Taylor also referenced this phrase when she was accepting an award for Love Story, and I'll put the link to that in the description for this episode, because I think it's incredible to see a very young Taylor Swift saying, "But Daddy, I Love Him," when she's accepting an award. And just to point out that these two quite specific references that she's made to these 1989 films, The Little Mermaid and Dead Poets Society, both explore the themes of father figures trying to control and repress their children, to stop their children from following their dreams and living in a free way. And so that's really sitting with me here. And I also want to say that the inclusion of But Daddy, I Love Him sent me down an incredible queer mermaid history rabbit hole about a month ago. And I'm hoping that that's going to become a full-blown podcast episode, because there's way too much to name here. But I really want to name Howard Ashman. If you have never heard of him, please go and Google him. There's a documentary on him called Howard, and he was the lyricist for Disney's Little Mermaid, also the lyricist for films like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. And he was a gay man, and he died of AIDS just before Beauty and the Beast hit the screens. It's a really, really sad story. It's also a story that I feel really honored to have learned about his life. And, you know, before his gay influence on The Little Mermaid, the original Little Mermaid also has queer context in terms of the Hans Christian Andersen original and the tragic ending of that tale. Pun, tale. So please go and look up those things if you're wanting a little taste of the rabbit hole that I've gone down in terms of queer mermaid history. Other than that, I'm not going to say too much more about my impressions of the track list. I'm most excited about the last five or so tracks, despite the fact that I am frustrated with Taylor's what feels to me like a money grab and tactic to get more people buying her music. and increasing records of, like, the record of number of vinyls sold, CDs sold, but the bonus tracks, The Albatross, The Black Dog, The Bolter, The Manuscript, I'm really enjoying those track titles before the release. I'm also looking forward to Clara Bow. Many, many galas have posted analyses on Reddit, etc., about the sort of queer speculation around Clara Bow, but I'm interested in that. I'm also interested in The Alchemy, partly because one of the reasons I became a gala in the first place was tracking Taylor's use of the theme gold across her discography and realizing that her use of the term gold was going from positive to negative, despite the fact that the relationship that I thought gold was describing was still supposedly positive. So I'm interested to see whether The Alchemy continues that gold theme. The other thing that's worth mentioning is the Beatles' White Album and the fact that Tortured Poets Department is seen as a white album because of the colour schemes that she's choosing for this album. The phrase, this is from an article in Pitchfork. And of the Beatles' albums, none, not even Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, rivals the Beatles as a rock archetype. The phrase, it's like their white album, applied to records, and there's a list of different records. And this phrase has long been accepted as critical shorthand. To use the expression is to conjure a familiar cluster of associations. The work in question is large and sprawling, overflowing with ideas, but also with indulgences, and filled with a hugely variable array of material, some of which might sound great one day and silly the next. A band's white album is also most likely assembled under a time of great stress, often resulting in an artist's peak, but one that nonetheless scatters clues to its creator's eventual demise. So this is very interesting in terms of Taylor's knowledge of, Taylor would definitely know about this phrase in the music industry of an artist's white album. And it's interesting that a white album is considered shorthand for an album that is overflowing, that feels really variable, but also that might be assembled under great stress. We've already got connotations of that in the lead up to the Tortured Poets Department, but also considered an artist's peak. And Taylor's already peaking in terms of celebrity and fame at the moment. Will she peak in artistry as well? But also the idea of clues to an artist's or creator's demise, which is very interesting to me. This leads me to my other thing that I want to mention in terms of on the White Album by the Beatles, there is like a bunch of strange conspiracy theories that came out of that album. For those who don't know, there's the Paul is Dead conspiracy theory, which is seen as one of the biggest conspiracy theories in terms of the music industry, I think, ever. And on a track called Revolution 9 on the Beatles' The White Album, if you played it backwards, you heard the words, "Turn me on, dead man." So this was seen as evidence. Again, I enter into evidence. And this sort of conspiracy theory is seen as like a kind of folk tale, but also it's really important to note that one of the biggest conspiracy theories around Taylor Swift is the Gayla theory. And this idea of like playing things backwards, fans creating things out of nothing. But also, the Beatles definitely played into these different things. There are a lot of critics that speak to the fact that the Beatles played into this sort of fan frenzy of looking for Easter eggs and that kind of thing. And so it's really interesting to me that Taylor could be playing into this idea of the Beatles' White Album, not just for what I said earlier, but also for weird Easter eggs and clues that are hidden in it for fans to find. The other thing that I just want to touch on is that, to me, the relevant themes that I'm seeing crop up here in the lead up to Tortured Poets Department is obviously the theme of poetry and poems. And for those who don't know, in terms of the plethora of connections to Reputation,
we have so far, especially given that the public narrative is that Reputation was the start of the Joe Alwyn relationship and the new love that she was finding in amongst all of the bombs and kind of damage to her reputation that was happening on the outside in her life. And then Torture Poets Department potentially being the end of that narrative arc. It's interesting to me that Taylor Swift released 3 poems in the Reputation era in a way that she hadn't before. So that poetry theme sort of bookends of poetry in Reputation era and poetry of the Tortured Poets Department is strong here. And just to speak a bit about business jargon that we've had before, because we've got a lot of that leading up to the Tortured Poets Department. And I specifically want to take note of the jargon in Lavender Haze. She's got no deal, the 1950s shit they want from me. Get it off my desk. I've been under scrutiny. You handle it beautifully, handling it, and talking your talk. So Lavender Haze really lends itself to this sort of business talk that she's got in Tortured Poets Department and the idea of the commodification of love, the idea that she's kind of creating products out of these love stories and doing these PR relationships as love stories for the public to consume. And there's many where that came from. Obviously, if you want to hear more, you can look at it in my database. I really want to touch on to close that in my analysis of the Tortured Poets Department, I'm really with the concept of conflicting feelings, conflicting concepts, contrasts, juxtapositions, and, you know, the best way of speaking about that is with the concept of yin and yang. But we've got these ideas of, on the one hand, corporate language like department and chairman, and then on the other hand, tortured poets and veins of pitch black ink, emotions. We've got this idea of the different eras that we're seeing. And if you want to see more on that, you can see my bonus episode on the Patreon that's about the website glitch that happened before the announcement of Tortured Poets Department. So we've got this idea of things that are programmed, machines that are programmed, and then when the machines malfunction. So department, tortured poet, department versus tortured poet, programmed versus malfunctioning, legal terms, law and order versus rebellion, fresh out the slammer, but daddy, I love him, I can fix him. You've got black versus white. You've got that black is the colour for Reputation and white is the colour for Tortured Poets Department. And what I'd love to point out here, and I'm not the only Swiftie that's pointed this out, is that the yin and yang symbol is present in the Tortured Poets Department logo. So the P and the D in the Tortured Poets Department. And for everyone who's wondering if they're listening through audio, if you just Google images right now, Tortured Poets Department logo, you'll be able to see what I mean. We have a yin and yang symbol at the very end of this acronym. And I looked into yin and yang this morning. It was a really interesting read. If you've never looked into it, but you've always known what yin and yang kind of means, I would really recommend looking into even just the Wikipedia page for yin and yang. Because to me, this concept of yin and yang, especially relating to these forces that I've been speaking about that feel really contrasting and there's tension between them. When I was first putting this analysis together, I was thinking about how it feels like there are a lot of polar opposites going into this album. And the fact that the title name has a polar opposite in it for me of a tortured poet in a department and how much those concepts clash. Just before recording this, reading the yin and yang symbolism, I was struck by the idea that yin and yang really speaks to balance, harmony, natural cycles, and the fact that you can't have yin without the yang. And so it sort of turned this analysis on its head for me, because before looking up the concepts of yin and yang, I was thinking like, wow, this album is dealing with, you know,
parts of Taylor Swift that are fighting with each other, the sort of clashes that happen in terms of, you know, the business-minded mastermind Taylor Swift corporation side of things, the strategy. And then the raw, tortured poet, the kind of really emotional artist version of Taylor, and how like much these concepts clash. But now, looking at this definition and the history of how yin and yang came to be as a concept, I'm thinking about whether this album is going to explore the need for both of those things. The idea that when you think of the concept Taylor Swift, it incorporates painful emotional art, and that's what she's known for, and strategy, business models, law, publicity. And, you know, I've done a lot of work recently on separating those two parts of her out so that I can enjoy the art and not have to participate as much with the celebrity business capitalist side of things, the side of things that has a vinyl variant for every different bonus track. And I wonder whether this album is going to speak to the kind of harmony that both of those parts have with each other, and the tension between them. I don't think that that's not going to be included. I'm interested in, there was this idea when I was reading about yin and yang, about how it sort of originated from this idea of like one side of a mountain being hit by the sun and being lit, and consequently that meaning that the other side of the mountain is in shadow. But as the sun moves across the sky, the shadow part of the mountain becomes lit, and the previously sunlit part of the mountain becomes dark. And so there's the fact that yin and yang is part of like a cycle too, and also a part of what I've been speaking about this sort of the facade that Taylor presents and then the real emotions underneath. And kind of the fact that yin and yang energy is sort of can be considered masculine and feminine, or can be considered sort of active and passive. And so I'm also interested in this idea of what's in the shadow, what are the things that she's not sharing with us, what are the things that she's keeping in the dark, and what are the things that she is shining a light on publicly? Because we only ever see the side of the mountain that Taylor wants us to see in terms of her inner world. There's always going to be a shadow part. And that dance of always being aware of the shadow that she is presenting or hiding, you know, I prefer hiding in plain sight, that is part of the allure of Taylor Swift's art, I think, for me. Her playing with this idea of, I'm going to choose what I present to you, and I'm going to show you what I've hidden inside of that. You're going to constantly be curious about the shaded side of my mountain. I hope that makes sense. And so the other thing that this episode explores is, yeah, the idea of fans filling in the gaps. Obviously, white kind of gives me this idea of a blank page, and the fandom, there's been barely any promo for Tortured Poets Department, and the Swifties have really filled that hole, filled that gap like a vacuum with all of their theories about Joe Alwyn and cheating on Taylor and all of the ways that they're hating him. And I think that that really plays into this concept of her sort of public persona and private persona, and kind of, yeah, the corporate, the publicity element of Tortured Poets Department, of kind of a department coming up with a strategy of, we're going to leave a big blank space before this album and we're going to let the fans fill it. That's interesting. I'm going to finish there. If you are someone who's curious about hearing my thoughts on the track list, especially given the fact that I have recorded an entire episode on the Albatross, because there was a lot of queer history and a lot of literature history that came out of my research on the Albatross. So if you're interested in my takes on the track list of Tortured Poets Department and some deeper analysis on that, as well as the bonus episode on the Albatross, those can be found in my Patreon, and links to those things will be in the bio for this episode. So please go and check those out if you're wanting to. The last announcement, the most important announcement, is that there'll be a Tortured Poets Department listening party. A lot of people won't listen to this episode before Tortured Poets Department is released, but for the lucky few who do, we are doing a fundraiser for Gaza. And so currently we've raised, let me do the maths. We're looking at nearly $1,900 American, which means that we've nearly raised $2,000 American. Just doing a listening party for galas. So thank you everyone who contributed to that. I'm really proud to be part of this community and bringing all of these different parts of my life together, which I hope it feels like I've done in this episode as well. I want to take this opportunity to thank Jem and Nell for helping make this episode possible and make a lot of what you know of as Friends of Dorothea possible. As someone who's neurodivergent, it is really difficult to get this content out. Editing is really difficult for me, and motivating myself, being able to discuss ideas with them. Yeah, it has been a real gift to have those two as collaborators on the Friends of Dorothea project, and they've changed my life. So yeah, shout out to Jem and Nell. Thank you for all your help. And finally, shout out to all of my Patreons on Friends of Dorothea. You are the reason that I am able to spend the time creating this episode and spend the time researching all of the things I've researched over the last few months in order to make this episode happen. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you're listening to this after the Tortured Poets Department was released, I hope you've enjoyed listening to that. And yeah, stay tuned for my analyses of all of the tracks for Tortured Poets Department. I'm really looking forward to going on that journey with you all. Okay, signing off as chairman of the Friends of Dorothea Department. And yeah, I'll see you on the other side. Bye.